Let's change the world together. Welcome to the Snapcast, the podcast for all nonprofit professionals, bringing you interviews and amazing ideas for nonprofit leaders.
Hello, this is Mickey Tsai. I'm your host for this episode of the Nonprofit Snapcast. Very happy to be sitting today with my friend John McGee. John, how are you doing today?
I'm doing very well, Mickey. I'm delighted to be here.
Great. Now that we have this recording successfully moving in the right direction, we have quite a bit to talk today about nonprofit regulations, the 990, the PPP loan forgiveness thing. Where shall we get started?
Let's start with regulations, because it's the one area that nonprofits frequently forget they have.
Okay, great. I'll let you drive the agenda because you know a lot more about this than I probably ever will. So
it was interesting, Mickey, as I was preparing for this conversation and this on these two topics and reviewing material, new regulations and new information came out as recently as yesterday.
Wow.
So regulatory oversight of nonprofits is an ongoing and, in some ways, constantly changing process. And many nonprofits don't recognize that they start with a threefold overlook situation where the federal government's doing some of it, the state's doing some of it, and the local government is doing some more. And the reason they forget that is because they don't always stop to think about them. They start out originally as a corporation. In order to become a nonprofit recognized 501c3, you start off by registering with your state as a corporation, meeting all the requirements that your individual state has for you to become incorporated. You then take that process and then submit an application to the IRS, telling them that you, on a form 1023 or 1024, that this is who you are, this is what you're going to do, and this is why you're going to do it. The IRS will then rule on whether you meet the requirements of being a C3. And I say that because there are actually, under the Internal Revenue Code, Section 501C, 29 subdivisions. C3 is the most commonly known. The C4 is the next most commonly known. The C4 is the social agencies, the Lions Clubs, the Rotary, Kiwanis, Civitan, Optimist, and ironically, the PACs, the Political Action Committees. We're not here to talk about the C4s, but every once in a while, I'll touch on overlapping issues. So you get approved by the IRS, and now you're free, you're able to operate. The interesting thing is you are allowed as a applicant for your 501c3 status to offer individuals tax deductibility on their donations from the moment you apply for this, your C3 status as with the IRS. Here's the catch. If they deny you that status, you have to then go back to the donors and say, your donations don't qualify as tax deductible. But if they do, they provide you that status, all those donations that you may have received prior to receiving your certification letter from the Internal Revenue Service saying you are now a recognized 501c3 are tax deductible.
So even though you're allowed to solicit donations, once you submit the application, it's probably just a better way to wait until you get some sort of acknowledgement from the IRS to take any donations.
It is if you're, you know, not confident that your application is going to meet muster. But if you are following the protocol, the rate of turndown by the IRS for an applicant of a C3 is pretty low. So you really kind of have to be outside the range. A lot of nonprofits, what they'll do is they'll simply extract the code, the language of the code, and say, that's our purpose. And that gives them a lot of flexibility, because if you decide, for example, I want to be a scholarship granting organization, and I'm going to give scholarships to worthy young men and women coming out of inner city schools who want to pursue careers in the sciences or the math area. And that's what you set yourself up to. And then you find you're real successful raising money, and you have more money than you can give away in scholarships, and want to do something else? You don't have that flexibility. So there's an advantage when you apply to establish as much flexibility in your application as you can. And then you can narrow it down in your corporate bylaws and your mission and other areas. So there's a way to narrow your focus down in activity, but still keeping a big enough umbrella under you in case you need to kind of shift your mission or your focus.
Okay.
Once you're set up, now the state gets involved, the local government. You rent a building. All the codes that require, that go into effect of owning or being in a building and being a tenant and all that stuff applies. You have all the same regulations that oversee you as a corporation with employees, with all that stuff applies to you. So a not-for-profit organization, 501c3, is exempt only from federal corporate income tax. That's what that status gives you. The other thing it gives you is the ability to offer tax deductibility for donations made to your organization without a quid pro quo. There's a couple types of fundraisers that people like to do that don't quite qualify as tax deductible events. The most common one is a raffle or a charitable auction. The charitable auction, if you have to offset the fair market value of the good against what you're paying for, there's some areas that you have to be really concerned with. But most of that falls under the oversight of the states. While the IRS grants you that status, the states are the enforcers. And the states vary all over the map as to how they enforce charitable regulations. Partly because, in most cases, 70 to 80% of not-for-profits are small, under $500,000. In some cases, I've seen surveys a few years back where 70 to 80% of the not-for-profits in the state were under $250,000. So in terms of huge impact to finite enforcement dollars, the state's not going to necessarily look at not-for-profits as being the place where you're going to see big fines and big penalties. That said, that doesn't mean that you're not, can't get caught doing something wrong. The other side of it, and this is kind of very relevant in today's COVID-19 world, being a good nonprofit citizen not only helps you, but helps all your fellow nonprofits. Because when one nonprofit gets painted with a bad brush, they all seem to get painted with that bad brush. So it helps you as a nonprofit to be compliant. And there are all sorts of strange rules that get fit in here. A couple of years ago, the Obama administration attempted to revise the law on overtime and at what point were you an exempt or non-exempt employee in terms of the salary threshold. That process got rejected because in some ways people perceived they bumped it up too high. The Trump administration renewed that effort. They have recently implemented new overtime pay rules, and those rules don't simply apply to the for-profit world. They apply to all organizations. So nonprofit entities that are paying their employees need to be aware of what employment law is. And some employment law comes from the federal government and some employment law comes from the state government. So regulations that apply to corporations frequently apply to not-for-profits. And the distinguishing characteristic in this is size. And ironically, that's true with corporations. The law is written and says if you're under, say, 50 employees, this is how the law works for you. If you're over 50 employees, this is how the law works for you. That applies whether you're a for-profit or not-for-profit. And I say that with the understanding that it doesn't matter whether you're a 501c3 or any one of the 501c's. Those rules work that way. You start out originally as a corporation subject to corporate laws. That said, you now have federal oversight. Primarily, how do you keep your status as a C3? That requires annual filings. You have state oversight. That requires annual filings. Those annual filings are normally your corporate registration. And if you're reside in one of the 45 states that require charitable solicitation registration, your annual renewal of your charitable solicitation registration. How that works, who you apply to, differs between the states. They normally deal with either the Attorney General or the Secretary of State. Florida uses the Secretary of Agriculture. I don't understand why, but they do. So you need to know where you need to apply. And you might say, well, I only have to worry about Georgia because, I mean, my charity is in Georgia. But if I solicit in the surrounding states, if my footprint is in the surrounding states, I have to know whether I should be registered to solicit and also whether I have to be registered as a foreign corporation. So knowledge of your service footprint and your fundraising footprint become very important as to how you interact with states other than that state in which you're domiciled.
So I have a couple questions at this point. The first one is, who in the organization is responsible for keeping track of this paperwork? And the second question is more of an observation, maybe not quite a question, but it sounds like a lot to keep track of, but I suspect it's not. I suspect it's like one of those things where you have to keep, you know, you have to keep on top of something that gets done once a year, and then the rest of the year you can spend doing your mission activities for the nonprofit.
Well, the board theoretically has a responsibility ensuring that the organization is compliant with all applicable laws. The board isn't going to know what all the, for the most part, the board is not going to know what all the applicable laws are. Therefore, it's going to fall, for the most part, on the executive director or some senior staff person to be aware of what these issues are. And what I have learned over 30 years is that the vast majority of nonprofit executive directors don't have time to pay attention to this issue. So they become aware of them only by inheriting process. We've registered, the registration renewal comes, we do it every year. Or because they've attended some training or conference that makes them aware that they need to do something. But there is a responsibility to do the appropriate steps. And I'll give you an example. A number of years ago, agencies that were able to apply for VOCA and VAWA within the state of Georgia were given the opportunity to enhance the size of their grants, and it required some risk taking. And the overseeing agency for those grants, which was the Criminal Justice Coordinating Council, used as one of their criteria to determine whether the recipient was eligible to receive their funds were their registrations current? And the only particular registration they were concerned with was, were you registered to conduct business in the state? Was your corporate registration current? A number of agencies had their grant awards deferred with a reduction of that award by 10%. Now, when I was running the agency that was in that proverbial boat of applying for VOCA and VAWA money, I couldn't have afforded a 10% reduction in income. So there is a cost, a potential cost to noncompliance that is above and beyond the cost that might occur by any fines or penalties that that the regulatory oversight agency might put on you. So who's responsible? If the board doesn't do it, and there is no realistic reason to expect you're going to have an expert on the board on these matters, it is the responsibility of the executive director to keep the board informed of what needs to be done. And yes, for the most part, this is, you know, in Georgia, the renewal process is online. It takes all about 5 minutes
right,
at worst. So it's not a long, time-consuming, or for that matter, expensive process. But failure to do it can be very costly.
Right. Okay, so where do we transition from here? I mean, we've talked about...
After you exclude all the governmental oversight, and, you know, you keep in mind they come from all sorts of different directions that you might never think about. So it's in a executive director or that individual's management team to kind of try to monitor this stuff. You have regulations put on you by the funders. The most commonly known, you know, regulation or is restricted funds. You know, in the current, you know, COVID-19 disruption of normal cash flow, there's a lot of people screaming about people who have these huge endowments, universities, hospitals, then why aren't they just, you know, using this money for operating funds? Well, one of the reasons they're not using it for operating funds is because the money that was given to them for a specific purpose. If they have $10 million that is set aside for foundation for scholarship funds, they can't all of a sudden just decide, and that's what it was given for, specifically for scholarship funds. They can't all of a sudden say, well, we need money to pay, you know, our light bills, so we're going to take money out of the scholarship fund.
Right.
So the first regulatory oversight, if you want, is donor intent. What is the individual's intent in use of the money that they give you? And it seems simple. Nonprofits can get in trouble for not using it. Donors have actually sued to retrieve their donations if it's not used in accordance to the way they want. So there's an expense here that is both financial and reputational. The last thing you really want to do is have your nonprofit, you know, in the front page news, because a donor, normally someone who has a name recognition, is accusing you of misuse of funds.
Right.
So that's the big area of of issue. Most funds raised by nonprofits have an implied intent of use for. Not all the money is not always used that way. Red Cross will solicit funds during a major disaster. As a donor, your understanding is that's what it's for, but that may not be the intent of Red Cross.
I see what you're saying.
The clarity of message becomes important.
I was going to ask, is that actually true? Because whenever I've you know, solicited for funds for a nonprofit, I always just say, I don't actually use the words general operating expense, but I never try to tie it to an event or to a line item in the budget.
And that would be the wisest way to do it.
Yeah.
Because once you start suggesting an intent, that is what the best one I remember was after the tsunami in Indonesia. Doctors Without Borders got more money for tsunami relief than they could use. They just recognized they could, and they actually went back to the donors and asked them if they could use it for another purpose.
Yeah.
And because of the transparency, Doctors Without Borders said they had nobody said, no, you can't use it for another purpose. So the clarity or specificity of the ask helps that dialogue and discussion. Mm-hmm. When I have asked as a seeking funds, I've always tried to make it non-programmatic, but organizational support.
Right.
Leaving me the ability to use those monies where most needed. And the irony of it is, for small nonprofits, the toughest expense to cover is the administrative overhead. It sounds weird to say, but nobody really wants to pay for the cost of running the business. They want to pay or contribute to the cost of doing good. Well, to do good, you have to run the business.
Right,
there's
exactly.
There's an expense there, and it becomes really important for nonprofit organizations to keep that option as wide open as possible when they're soliciting. But if there is an implied specific use, you have to be real careful on how that is received by the donor and the donor public. And there has been a number of organizations who have received bad press because the monies they raise for something are not equal to the money they spend for that same crisis, disaster issue. And there are a number of, you know, agencies out there, Charity Navigator, for example, who evaluate nonprofits in terms of a lot of conditions and issues. And there's a way to look at, see, you know, what the integrity factor is of a nonprofit. Better Business Bureau has its own unit that looks at not-for-profit organizations and what their reliability is. So as a donor, a potential donor, there are many ways to get information about a nonprofit that is beyond simply the solicitation that you might receive from that nonprofit.
Right.
Particularly if you don't have a natural relationship with them. I remember many years ago getting a call from somebody in New Hampshire who had received a call from the agency I was with, telemarketer. And he had done some research after he got the call, and he asked me, why should I give money to you through the telemarketer when I can make the donation directly to the agency? And I said, well, sir, I'll certainly gladly take your donation directly.
Yeah.
But, you know, you were solicited by a telemarketer. He says, yeah, but the telemarketer takes a cut.
Yeah.
The telemarketer also needs to be a registered entity. And not only in the state in which the nonprofit they are representing is domiciled, but also in the states in which they're soliciting. So if you feel uncomfortable with a telephone solicitation, there's a number of ways of checking whether that's a valid solicitation. There's also 25 states in which they're required to actually give a disclosure about the nature of the solicitation rather than simply, you know, this is Fred soliciting from whatever. So the telemarketers, the fundraising consultants, they frequently fall under some of the same regulatory oversight at the state level that a nonprofit might have in terms of charitable solicitation. Mm-hmm. So it's not like the Wild West where anybody can do anything. There are oversight responsibilities, and a lot of states produce some very good reports on the type of revenue raised by a fundraising consultant firm or telemarketing fundraising firm versus the amount of money the nonprofit actually gets. So there's that process that occurs in the government oversight that simply in the report generation can give you a lot of information that is different than enforcement. Most enforcement I see occurring in nonprofit regulations has to do with the what I would consider the next major category of resource development, and that's government grants and contracts. Government grants and contracts normally come with a whole series of expectations and conditions and assurances that you're going to obey all these rules and regulations that are attached to the document, many of which nonprofit organizations, when they get them, they just simply sign with no knowledge of what any of these actually apply to.
Right.
I'll give you one example of how a regulation from a federal fund source passed through to the state, managed by the state grantor, worked a number of years ago. That same VOCA VAWA money, which VOCA is Victims of Crime Act and VAWA is the Violence Against Women's Act. In that same pot of responsibility that the Criminal Justice Coordinating Council had, they had to report back or train the executive directors on use of money. Generally speaking, the use of money is you spend it, it's done.
Right.
One of the interesting stipulations on these grants is if you bought something tangible, like a police car, as long as that police car was in service, you were still using the money. And there were reports that a police agency in the state of Georgia was not providing translation services to individuals they apprehended because they weren't, you know, it was cost prohibitive in some ways for them to do so. But the grant required that you provide services to your clients. An apprehended individual is a client for a police office or a police force in the language they're most comfortable. And even though the cars had been purchased and had been on the road for a number of years, they were still resources. They were still under the conditions of that grant that required them to provide services in the language they're most comfortable. So when you get a grant that comes from the federal government, it comes with all sorts of assurances. And not only does the current administration need to know it, because most times you're really talking about funds that are going to be used in a fiscal year, but subsequent individuals need to know if case there was a capital purchase done in which those funds are still covered under the terms of the award, the grant award. Mm-hmm. So the grant award might be for the fiscal year, but the use of the funds might be for 5 years because that's the life of the item you bought. That item, and therefore the agency, is under the conditions of that grant for 5 years. Mm-hmm. So you have to be real careful about how you use it. Where most people get in trouble is they decide to use funds awarded to them at some level by some agency for purposes other than which it's intended. And normally that it ends out in some form of fraud or clear misuse of money.
Right. So we are rapidly coming up on half an hour. I'm sorry to interrupt, John. And we've blown away our 15-minute deadline and then some. How do we bring this home? How do we bring this home for nonprofits? You know, we've talked about a number of different things. Can we do a summary or
the single most important thing for a nonprofit to realize is that they, like all corporations, have a number of entities that have potential legal oversight authority on them.
Right.
And they need to be conscious of who they are and what the expectations are by those agencies of their organization. In some cases, it's fairly simple. In other cases, it's much more complex. But ignorance is not an excuse. And there are good websites out, everything from the IRS, its own website, through Charity Navigator, GuideStar, a host of other sites that can help you work through that process so that you are as close to compliant as reasonably possible.
Yeah. Right. And there's still so much more to talk about in terms of the kinds of gifts and I mean, we haven't even touched on the issue of COVID-19 fundraising at this point.
Right. And you know, just as a aside, the 14th permutation of regulations on the PPP program came out yesterday.
Wow.
You know, and all of these are subject to public comment before they actually go in force.
Right, right.
Man. So, you know, that whole issue is, you know.
How do you keep it all straight, John? How do you do it?
Well, if you saw my little office right now, just to prepare for this, I have about 150 pages of printed material that is recent. I've been doing this for 25 years. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, recognize that the power to tax is the power to destroy, and the power to regulate is also the power to destroy.
Yeah.
And I truly believe that if you do your best job staying, we all benefit.
Yeah.
Because none of us want a bloody nose and none of us want to give someone else a black eye.
Right. That's right.
but it is a constant process. I love doing it. I mean, I really do. That may sound like a, you know, policy gun, but I love trying to stay on top of it. What amazes me is how well they can hide it. I mean, I won't even talk about, you know, we didn't even talk about the fact that a lot of this stuff gets buried inside other legislation.
Right.
The Pension Protection Act, Sarbanes-Oxley, you know, both of those, you know, were not things that anyone would have thought were directed at nonprofits, and they were, or they had provisions in them that were directed at nonprofits.
Right, right. Okay. So here's what I think we should do. Let's call this episode here, and let's do this again next week or in the next 10 days. And just do a multiple series of these. There's just way too much to talk about.
Oh, yeah. Tell me about it.
Yeah, way too much to talk about. John, if a listener wanted to get in contact with you with any questions on these matters, how would you suggest they do that?
I would use my McGee Consult. And you're now going to ask me if I can remember my places. Yeah, McGee Consult at gmail.com. So that would be MCGEE. consult@gmail.com.
Okay, great. Thank you. And I will look forward to setting a date to do more of this with you, because I clearly, as we've said, there's just plenty of regulatory information to sift through that I think nonprofits should definitely be aware of.
Correct.
John, thanks for taking the time to make this recording with me today.
My pleasure.
And to our listener, thanks as always for joining us. We value your time and hope that you find this information useful. We value your suggestions via our own website, nonprofitsnapcast.org. You can use the contact us form there to tell us who else you think we should have on the show or what other topics we might cover. In the meantime, we hope you and yours are staying safe. We'll see you with another episode in a few days.
This has been the Snapcast. Thank you for joining us.